August 2011. This month in Control System Security, I talk with Joel Langill, the SCADA hacker, about Network Access Control NAC. It's a relatively new security product that Joel believes would be a good fit for many ICS networks. Next, I talk with Patrick Miller of EnergySec. Patrick and the rest of the EnergySec crew have been attending a lot of conferences, and I pick Patrick's brain about what he's hearing out there. What are some of the trends and interesting topics that are coming up at these events? All this month in Control System Security. This month in Control System Security is brought to you by Schweitzer Engineering Labs. SEL designs powerful and manageable user-based access controls for both serial and Ethernet control system networks. Learn more about the SEL 3025 SCADA Shield and the SEL 3620 Ethernet Security Gateway or other SEL security products today at selinc.com/cybersecurity. And by Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks at waterfall-security.com. And Nitro Security. They're the leader in security event management and compliance solutions for industrial control systems. Learn more at nitrosecurity.com. Joining me on the podcast is Joel Langill. He is the founder of SCADA Hacker, and you can read his tweets at SCADA Hacker and his blog and his website, which is very informative, scadahacker.com. Joel also does control system security training for InfoSec Institute, and you'll see him at a lot of conferences and events presenting on the topic. So welcome to the podcast, Joel.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. It's good to be here.
Is this the first time we've had you on?
Actually, it's not. I also co-hosted one with Eric Byers a few months back when we released our paper on how Stuxnet spreads.
Oh, that's right. That was an excellent paper. I know that was very well received by the community. The reason I wanted to have you on this time was you and I had a bit of a Twitter back and forth or tweet stream back and forth a couple of months ago regarding the Siemens Automation Summit. And I think that issue has been discussed quite a bit, ad nauseum almost. But there was a little thread in that tweet conversation we had that I think is worth talking about more, and that's the concept of network access control, or NAC, as part of a control system security solution. Because in the tweets, that was something that you were saying, you know, showed a lot of promise and you were very encouraged by. So maybe we should start out by just giving the listeners a quick overview as to what NAC is.
Okay. Well, NAC is actually a fairly new technology, which, as its name implies, is designed to address a comprehensive solution around granting network access. The reason that I'm a big proponent of network access control is that most people are pretty aware of the standard process of connecting to a network, authenticating against resources on that network, being granted some level of authorization on that network, whether it's to file shares on a server or access to applications or databases. And then, of course, on the side, there's always the accounting piece or the logging piece, which is actually keeping track of what you've done, things that have happened that are maybe anomalies that are not supposed to happen, visiting invalid URLs or IP addresses or so on. But where NAC actually adds to that basic AAA philosophy of access is it does two additional things that I think are really going to add strength to a good, solid, resilient control system security infrastructure. And the first is where it does what we would call a pre-admission assessment of the host. So what this basically means is that it looks at the device that's trying to connect to the network, and actually before it's even granted IP addresses and switch level access, it assesses this device to make sure it's deemed healthy. And healthy can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. It could mean that it's running a supported operating system. It could mean that it has current security patches installed or that it's running some form of antivirus software. But the piece that I really am a big proponent of is what's called the post-admission access control, which is once the device, and this device can be a combination of a person and a computer, once this device has been authenticated, any kind of keys have been exchanged, whatever it takes to guarantee that this particular device is safe and ready to access the network, the post-admission NAC features now control the actual resources that a given device can communicate with. And this is something that I'm a very huge proponent within industrial control security, because oftentimes when we see remote exploits being launched against vulnerabilities, they would come from foreign devices, or they would come from devices that are not supposed to be performing a specific action. And those actions in general are known in advance. That's why I really like control systems in terms of their simplicity, because there's really a limited number of hosts performing a limited number of tasks, whether these tasks are applications or communication ports and services that are being used. It's very manageable, unlike a general purpose IT infrastructure where there's a variety of hosts all doing a variety of tasks, and that number grows exponentially as you add more hosts. But what we can then do with the post-admission control is that now we can actually lock down, for instance, a given controller or PLC communicating at the switch level with a particular HMI or a particular server. So it kind of provides a life cycle of access, both from the initial connecting it into the network port all the way through the application starting to communicate and share information.
So is NAC then enforcing this at the switch level, or where is this being enforced?
Well, that would depend on the particular vendor whose application is being used. So NAC is currently offered by pretty much the full spectrum of vendors. Microsoft and the operating system suppliers have their version. Microsoft happens to call theirs network admission control, and or network admission protection. Cisco has one that they offer, which, of course, that would take advantage of switch-level functions. And, of course, my particular favorite is the one offered by Enterasys, because what Enterasys switches support is the concept of role-based access. And in control systems, there's a current momentum that's really driving people to start looking at providing resource access based on user or device roles. And what's really nice is that when a NAC solution is implemented, again, depending on the vendor, some of them are actually able to implement role-based access, which would then drive the switch so that not only is it enforced with policies like Microsoft's Active Directory, but the switch is now physically restricting the MAC addresses, we would say, that a particular device or resource can see. So it really starts to bring our control system networks. It kind of creates a multiple subnetted type environment where a particular host can only see a small subset of the overall network. And without that kind of technology, it's really hard to do that, because in general, everybody on a network can see everyone else, right? They have access to it because the switch is just going to create an ARP table and it's going to forward packets based on whoever happens to be there. And of course, you now have to implement security at the device. And of course, you and I have had great discussions, especially, you know, when we look at things like the recent Siemens vulnerabilities. It's going to be very hard to put security in legacy devices. So what would be nice is if we could layer an infrastructure on top of these legacy, less secure control devices to add some form of a defense-in-depth type strategy. And NAC is actually a very good way of doing one of these layers of protection.
It seems though a lot of what you're talking about there is available today in the infrastructure and switches, for example. Although I completely agree with you that the idea of limiting what's going over the network to what is required for operations is a key security principle that we need to implement more in this space, especially since the type of communication, as you mentioned, is so static, unchanging for the most part in terms of which devices are talking to which on which ports and using which services and such. But what are you getting by doing this for this post, what you're calling post-admission control, that you can't get from a access list in a switch, or implementing port security to control which MAC can connect into a port into a switch? What is NAC getting you above that on the post-admission control side?
Well, when we look at the post-admission, one of the reasons I really have been impressed with what I've seen of NAC so far is that it works at layer two in the architecture. And when we look at if we go down into the architectures of our typical enterprise where we've got control networks and production networks and office or enterprise networks hierarchically connected with demilitarized zones, unfortunately, access control lists are not implemented at layer two in that architecture. They tend to be implemented at layer three, which means they're only catching traffic once it crosses a security boundary. And what I'm starting to see when we do field assessments is that if an attack happens to be launched within a particular security zone, most architectures today, they have very little in the way of security controls that can both detect it as well as manage it and mitigate the consequences of that attack. So, for instance, if somebody happened to bring in a piece of accidental, unintentional, malicious code and infect the station, most of the time it will rapidly infect the entire network because there's little access control that takes place between these devices.
I guess I would agree with you that that's the current state, that we don't see a lot of that out there. But what we typically see, and it's, you know, I'm not necessarily saying they're the best product or the one that people should select, but what we typically see is a lot of Cisco switches out there, and can put access lists in Cisco switches to do exactly what you're talking about. And you can put port security on a Cisco switch to restrict which MAC address can be plugged in or which MAC address can access a port. Although it's pretty easy to spoof a MAC address, as I know. I guess maybe where NAC could help, that an access list couldn't help for this post-admission control, is this role-based thing. If you had multiple users at a specific computer, a computer that was used as an engineering workstation and an HMI, I guess then you could apply a different, quote, access list or different rules as to where that device could go, where that IP address for that computer would be allowed to go based on who was logged into it. But other than that, I'm not really seeing for the post-admission control side what I'm getting in NAC.
No, I very much agree. And again, there's a lot of ways to solve the problem. And I do very much agree with what you said on port security. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing a lot of sites that are implementing it, and I don't know whether or not this is vendor driven or maybe the inexperienced nature of those implementing these networks. But I agree, you and I both know that if we did two things, we would eliminate a lot of problems: going to port based security on the switches and going to static ARP tables in the devices. Just those two things alone really start to prevent a lot of these rogue attack vectors from starting to infiltrate these particular networks. The place that I, last fall at the ICS JWG conference, I introduced my strategy on remote access. And I agree that in the true control system environment, NAC's probably not the right answer. But when we start to look at these new methods of accessing our trusted networks, whether it's through wireless technologies and WLANs, or whether it's through remote access, here's where I really start to plug the value of NAC. Every best practice I've currently been working on, because I have a project right now on the books to do a wireless implementation, really misses the point that if you had three or four different roles of people that are accessing a wireless infrastructure, how can we restrict the network visibility of these particular users based on their role? And that now becomes much more challenging when we only look at ACLs. Because, agree, an ACL is one piece of NAC, but then what do we do about managing both the activity that's going on within the network, kind of like an IDS that's built into NAC, as well as the general assessment of the health of the device that's connecting? And that's what, you know, that's one of the, you know, there's five or six key phases or steps in NAC. And when we start to look at the overall solution, if we had locked cabinets with locked ports where nobody could go in and plug in a computer, I think the problem would be very straightforward. But we've both been in plants where we go into a control room and there happens to be a subcontractor there. He sees an open Cisco switch and he plugs his computer directly into that network. Those are the type of solutions that, again, if we can help automate the security around the solution, we'll probably have a more resilient system in the end. Because port-based security is a very manual task. I mean, it needs to be, you need to configure it, you need to know the devices that are there. At least with NAC, in some of these areas that tend to have some more risk for casual users or other types of users connecting, NAC starts to automate that particular activity.
Well, I guess on the port-based security, I think the auto-learning features are pretty, make it pretty simple, where you can just say, these are the devices hooked into my switch now, learn them, and then that's my setting. And I guess on the and I'm not always going to disagree with you because I want to talk about endpoint assessment, but on the remote access side, what we see most often is people using their VPN to say when someone authenticates to the VPN product, that user is going to get an address from this IP pool that's related to their role, and then they get assigned what they're allowed to get to based on the role they get and the IP address they're assigned based on that role. But I think the area that, you know, that we've finally gotten around to that I think is the most intriguing is this endpoint assessment, especially for computers that are not consistently in the control system space. So they're either remote access users or they're computers going in and out and sometimes connecting to the corporate network, sometimes connecting to the internet, and then connecting into the control system network. We'd like to see that never happen, but in reality, everyone knows it does. And this idea of being able to somehow assess the security of that, whether it be patches or antivirus or configuration settings or something, it could be quite powerful, I think. And that's always what I thought the kind of the power or the hope for NAC was.
No, I think that being able to take a look at a device before it's granted access is a really important feature. Again, so many people realize that it's very challenging to actively patch these control system infrastructures. I mean, we all know it needs to be done, but in reality, there are industries that just don't tolerate that kind of, they can't do it because, right, the second Tuesday of every month, you've got to restart these nodes, and there's a lot of operations that just can't manage that activity. So what I sure would like to do is at least build some barriers that would keep the potential ingress of something that could cause problems out. And agree, a VPN is one way, but I personally don't like to put all of my faith in a single technology. And And as we saw by that breach that occurred at the city of Corona in California, is that their whole access mechanism was based on a VPN. And once that VPN was breached, that person was then able to pretty much come in and have carte blanche access to the network. So I really like to layer something else on top of what people have been doing forever. I mean, VPNs are great, ACLs are great, but again, any good hacker knows how to walk an ACL and then craft packets that will allow you to utilize the ACL to go through the firewall. So again, the more we can do at the true switching fabric, I think the better off we'll be. So again, that's why there's a lot that occurs both pre-admission and post-admission with NAC that I think could add strength. And again, it's not going to be for everybody. It's going to be for people that have higher than average risk exposure to these type of attacks.
Have you seen it deployed anywhere yet?
No, I have not. I've seen it deployed, but I haven't seen it deployed in control systems. Because the company that really pushes this actively is Enterasys. I mean, because their whole concept behind switch implementation is policy-based switching. So this is a natural progression from them. And, of course, we just don't see a lot of Enterasys in the industrial space yet. But the concept there was just, you know, it goes so well with what we're trying to do as far as managing enterprise-wide authentication. And of course, I have other projects that I'm working where we're addressing the issues around Active Directory and how we authenticate user credentials, both in the office environment and in the trusted control system environment. The same thing applies with these networking devices. It would be nice if you could take a computer around and you could take your same laptop from the office environment and plug it into the control system environment. Of course, in order to do that, we need to follow pretty much standard best practices, which say that computer, if it's going to plug into a trusted network on a high security zone, it needs to at least be at the policy of other devices in that zone. And next, one way that we can enforce those policies, again, in an automated sense, because we know that automating security is going to help people follow it, implement it, manage it, and, of course, the full life cycle of dealing with security in the control system world.
I know in the IT world that NAC has had sort of a checkered past over the last 5 or 6 years in terms of gets real hot. I think in 2008, if I looked up the sales, it was starting to boom, and then it kind of went down in 2009 and came back a bit in 2010. But some of the issues with it have been the complexity to deploy it and the scale and management issues. And I'm sure that's getting better all the time. As you mentioned, Enterasys is kind of leading the way in that area. One of the things that I think would worry a control systems engineer is if we use this, and let's admit that it gives some benefits in terms of security, we also now, aren't we adding new points of failure wherever we're using this? Enterasys server that's being queried for the role, for the authentication, the authorization, for the endpoint assessment, that becomes now a critical component that has to be up for the system to run properly. Is that correct? Have we added that in, or is there a way to kind of say, if you can't talk to me, still allow someone to connect?
Well, no, you're exactly correct on that. I guess if we look at it from two different angles, when we go down to the control system network, the layer two part of the model, that's a very static network. So in general, once you've authenticated, there would be no real reason to deauthenticate. It's not like people come in and connect and disconnect a lot. So that particular implementation of NAC is very resilient to those kind of failure modes. So, you know, again, it's not like we're going to connect and disconnect computers quite often.
Well, that sounds like, Joel, that sounds a lot like the domain controller issue, is if you're caching credentials, if you lose a domain controller for a while, the systems that were connected will still be able to connect. Is it sort of the same thing as that?
Well, no, because once you've authenticated and been assigned the port that you are on your switch, or different manufacturers might assign VLANs and so on, that's done. So that server's now out of the game. You're right. If you had to shut the machine down and reconnect back in, you would have to go through that authentication step. But we're assuming that in general, it's not like a user logging off and logging on. It's the securing of the grouping of hosts within this network. But that really wasn't the angle I was feeling the biggest benefit in. The area that I see it really helping address what we're starting to see with, like, what we did in Night Dragon, and also what we saw in Stuxnet, was how the malicious code's able to traverse the DMZ and basically bounce off these transition zones that people are putting in. I think NAC in a DMZ has very high value in providing some additional barrier that's needed to keep unnecessary traffic from accessing the less secure world to the more secure world. And again, it all depends on the security model that we're looking at in a given plant. But the most important thing is to not depend on, for instance, an ACL. Because if the ACL is compromised, the network's compromised. So again, we like to at least have something else there that can provide some feature that if you are able to bypass one security measure, at least there's another wall that you have to come up against. Because when we look at those assessments and the reports from, you know, whether it's NIST or the National SCADA Testbed or INL, they all talk about firewalls. And firewalls seem to be what everybody says protecting their control system, yet firewalls and their improper configuration tends to be one of the highest vulnerabilities that are seen when we look at an external penetration of control systems from both enterprise networks and the less trusted networks they're connected to.
I think you hit, though, the right place to try this out. If you're going to try out NAC and where it might have the biggest benefit would be the switch in the DMZ. I can see that being an interesting deployment, and I'd really like to hear if somebody actually does that. That'd be interesting to talk to them about it. Just two quick questions for you then, because we're running out of time here. The PLCs and the other devices that are on the switch, they are authenticated, what, via their MAC address?
Yes.
So limited value there, really, because you're not...
That's correct.
Because it can be spoofed. But it certainly would help against a non-malicious attack, which, you know, Joe Weiss is always pointing out that a lot of the things that are happening to control systems are not attacks. So it would help out against a lot of those. And then the other question was, there's a lot of things that people can do out there. So, you know, we've talked about whitelisting and one-way firewalls and improved monitoring and not to mention all the administrative controls. Where do you put NAC in that list in terms of efficient risk reduction? When you're talking to clients, obviously each one will be different, but are you prioritizing NAC at this point? Is it something high on your list for a typical client of yours?
Well, where I'm placing NAC is in the areas of highest risk from the unknown users. So they tend to be in two areas. So you mentioned the DMZ as one. Actually, the one that I'm currently working on and hope to have some documentation developed within the next 4 to 6 weeks is around wireless. Because what people are wanting within a single industrial environment is a common wireless infrastructure that will allow various types of users to authenticate against the infrastructure and then restrict their access once they're in. So if it's somebody in the warehouse, they have no business getting on the control system network, so they need to be restricted in how they access their resources versus a mobile operator that may be using a wireless device to do automated rounds or so on and so forth. So that really ends up being the area that people see the interest in NAC. Because as you know, we've hinted at it, NAC is not an inexpensive solution. But we all have to do this based on risk. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at security. And again, if you have no way of really protecting the network from these outside connections, NAC may be one of the only things some of these customers can implement around securing the networks.
I know in the past there's been a lot of skepticism. If you go way back to things like antivirus and firewalls and control systems, and more recently skepticism about whitelisting and one-way security components. And what we've learned over time is that they have their place, and this might be a case where it's just a matter of finding the right place for this technology. But we'll have to see. I appreciate you coming on board. Joel, the listeners can track you at, they can follow your tweets at SCADAHacker, and easy enough, they can go to your website, SCADAHacker.com, right?
That is correct.
You're listening to the August 2011 edition of This Month in Control System Security. I wanted to remind our listeners that the S4 call for papers is still out, but it will be closing soon on September 15th. You can actually submit your proposed paper or presentation online. Just go to our website, digitalbond.com, look in the header there, and you'll see the S4 call for papers. Remember, this year we have still the traditional one-hour full paper, full presentation, but we also have slots for 15-minute and 30-minute presentations that don't require technical paper. The S4 event is looking really good. It's about two-thirds full, but we still are chasing some of the best research out there to make it a fabulous event. So please submit your fantastic research. This Month in Control System Security is brought to you by Nitro Security. Nitro Security is an active SCADA and industrial control system security research firm and the makers of NitroView Security Information and Event Management System, a specialized security and compliance console designed for operations across enterprise, supervisory, and control networks. See them at nitrosecurity.com. And by Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks. Learn more at waterfall-security.com. And Schweitzer Engineering Labs, SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable, at selinc.com/cybersecurity. On the phone now is Patrick Miller. He is president and CEO of EnergySec, and EnergySec also is very well known as the group that runs the NESCO program. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you, Dale. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to have you back on the podcast. So you and your team have been very busy travelers lately over the last maybe 6 to 9 months or maybe longer than that. But I follow a lot of you guys on Twitter, and I find you going to a variety of conferences. Is that primarily as outreach and introduction for NESCO, or is there some other purpose that's driving that travel to those events?
Yeah, it's really a little of both. Most of it is focusing on the NESCO program. With our organization, we've always been, you know, centered on information sharing. So that, as you can imagine, involves a tremendous amount of outreach. But getting the NESCO program off the ground and getting it in front of everybody and trying to bring in all of those parties, you know, we're with the program. Originally, EnergySec was just focusing on asset owners. We didn't have any relationship or involvement with the federal agencies or the vendor community in any way. We have actively excluded them. With the instantiation of NESCO, you know, really kind of rounded out the picture for EnergySec, where we're now bringing in the vendor fold and the government agency folks. So we're doing a lot more outreach, trying to figure out how they're all going to fit in this mix, and ultimately how we're going to somehow create a place or a space or a way where all of these parties with, you know, both competing and complementary goals can actually work together.
Well, that's good. And I guess I'm kind of going to maybe leech a little bit off all that travel and work you've done, because as I was thinking, you're going around there, you're talking to a lot of people, you're seeing a lot of things, a lot of presentations, a lot of booths. And I was just kind of curious, what were some of the hottest issues that people were talking about at these events related to ICS security? What's really hot these days, if you could maybe think of one to three things that you're running into?
You know, the top three, I would probably say Stuxnet, of course, is getting an enormous amount of airtime. I think it's probably taken up most of the airtime with focusing, you know, just on the ICS community. For some, it's trying to downplay the issue. For some, it's trying to hyperbolize the issue. I actually, you know, I've seen a fair bit of both ends of the spectrum, but I got to admit, I've also seen a fair bit of balance in the middle. So, you know, from my perspective, I think I haven't seen, you know, too much downplay, too much hype. I have actually seen a decent representation of the folks that kind of sit in the middle and have a good understanding of the situation. But, you know, you go to these events, and depending upon the organizer and how they've arranged the panels and whom they've invited, you can always tell whether or not you're going to get a certain type of flavor. But even then, you know, in speaking with the audience members is typically what we like to do. We really are there representing, you know, the kind of the wrench turners and the folks that do this every day, because our base is still those asset owners and the security professionals there. So yeah, I'd say Stuxnet definitely was probably one of the biggest things that we'd seen. You know, I took up most of the conversations. Most people wanted to know about it. And I guess you could kind of lump all of that into the whole, and I really hate to use it, but the APT world. There really isn't a better term yet that I've seen. So unfortunately, we'll have to throw the buzzword out there. But yeah, a lot of talk about things like Night Dragon, now Shady Rat, Stuxnet. I think for the most part, you know, as I mentioned, there's some balance, but there's still a lot of confusion around the other pieces. Stuxnet, I think, was analyzed by so many people so quickly and really so well that we got a good understanding of kind of what it was doing and how it was done. You know, there's some of the other pieces that were done by vendors, for example, and McAfee is kind of known for these kind of things, issuing these reports. They get some questionable, analysis from the industry. You know, the industry kind of feels as though this might be a marketing piece, to be honest, in some cases. But so we field a lot of questions about those kinds of things. The RSA token issue, that got a lot of airtime as well and a lot of discussion. You know, we have really different kinds of discussion, though, because we speak with some of the vendors about their issues, and we speak with the asset owners about their issues, and we speak with the feds about a lot of different things that they want to know about. And they're really, interestingly enough, they don't all have the same question. They're all asking kind of different things. So I would say just, you know, from a kind of a coalescence of questions and concepts and discussions, kind of the APT and Stuxnet-ish issues probably stole the show in a lot of cases.
Before you move on to number two, I'm really curious about how Stuxnet was treated. And obviously it was different everywhere, but if you could kind of pull together some trend. For example, when Aurora came out, the conversations seemed to be, we need to stop Aurora, which was really kind of silly because it was one issue out of many in the control system. I think it was really designed to just show that a cyber attack could affect a physical process, not that that specific attack was the thing we needed to worry about most. And the same thing with Stuxnet. Are people, when they're talking about Stuxnet in these conversations, is the focus really on Stuxnet specifically and Siemens and how to stop it or how to deal with this specific problem? Or are people becoming sophisticated enough to extrapolate that, or both in terms of the presenters and the audience picking up on that?
You know, really depends on who's presenting and what their angle is. I'd say by and large, we are finding a higher degree of, you know, I'd loosely use the term sophistication, but a deeper understanding of the fact that this is not just a one-off, and that this really is, you know, kind of a step one in a very long process of trying to solve the problem. You know, Aurora, you look back at this, and there was a massive knee-jerk reaction, but I think that one kind of opened the door. You know, it really, at least it made people aware of the fact that you could do this that didn't already know. I mean, most of us that have been dealing with industrial control systems, I mean, one of the utilities I work for actually took off the recloser wire back in the 80s because they burned a substation to the ground by accident. So it's just one of those things. We've known about this in the power business for a long time. So, you know, from a kind of a layman's perspective or a non-ICS world view, you know, that really kind of opened their eyes, and it shook a lot of Congress people because it had such a graphic and visceral video that came with it, right? And lots of, you know, fanfare about the fact that this could have been done. You know, so we've known about this. Those of us who've dealt with this for a long time knew about it, so it's nothing new to us. But I guess the average person is now actually gaining a deeper understanding that this really is kind of the tip of the iceberg, that this can happen, that it can happen to pretty much anybody. When I go to vendors and often speak with their user groups, for example, which is one of the things we really enjoy doing, but almost every vendor basically says, you know, it's just a matter that it happened to be Siemens. It could have been any one of us, and our name would have been on there. So that fact's not lost on them, and that fact isn't lost on their users either.
Well, that's good. Okay, why don't you plunge ahead with number two then?
I'd say number two, you know, I would almost say that it rivals Stuxnet, but you know, from an industrial control systems perspective, I think it's even kind of quirkier, if I could use that. It's more about the compliance issue. Now, you know, from the NERC CIP standards, they originally, oh gosh, you know, way back in 2001, 2002, were designed for control center IT systems. Really were not designed for industrial control system space. Then we kind of, unfortunately, shoehorned a bunch of different things into the existing framework of that standard, despite a lot of the discussion we had back in the day about splitting ICS elements out, about splitting generation and transmission elements, so that we would have either, you know, sections of the standard or separate standards for these really, you know, varied environments. Unfortunately, we ended up with a, you know, one-size-fits-some, and we're stuck with trying to figure out how we can actually apply a compliance regime onto industrial control systems and things like, you know, patch mandate cycles and password changes and many of the things that we talk about now with the technical feasibility exception world that's within that standard. That gets, you know, I would say equal time to the Stuxnet and the APT concerns. Really, those are the things that are on everyone's mind right now. It's almost pretty much tied for first place. Top two would be compliance and, you know, that growing kind of, you know, persistent and adaptive adversary kind of thing.
Are you seeing, I know no one's happy with the situation now, or very few people are happy with the situation now. Are you seeing anything on the solution side related to compliance in the future, or is it just a number of people from all different sides pointing out the problems with it?
Well, we could have a whole new podcast on the regulatory landscape, Dale, to be honest. I think, you know, just to summarize briefly, from what I'm hearing in my conversations at the regulatory layers, they're not happy with it. I mean, even NERC is unhappy with it. There's not, unfortunately, the process that we've all agreed to makes it very cumbersome to change. And there's benefit in that, and there's also detriment in that process. I mean, it's a very challenging way to actually make a standard. I think the reality is we're looking currently, and it's always been the case, but cybersecurity in particular can move so fast where you can have malware that can wrap the globe in a matter of seconds to minutes. And that's something that you just can't respond to at the utility pace, even for their business systems. I mean, in fact, most enterprises can barely do that no matter what they do, whether they have industrial control systems or not. So the fact that innovation and you know, malicious activity will outpace regulations, I think that's a given. So we've got to find a way where we can ultimately craft something that kind of embraces that, maybe provides enough of a, you know, regulatory framework or regulatory boundary on the outside that gives you a lot of latitude and flexibility to handle these issues as they happen, and embraces the fact that you are dealing with industrial control systems that in some cases can be, you know, 20, 30 years old.
That's a very logical, well-thought-out answer, but I guess I'm wondering what's happening at the events. Are Are people standing up and saying, this is what we need to do, we need to make these changes? Are you seeing anything along those lines, or is it more just here's where we are and here's the problems with that?
Yeah, the standards drafting teams are trying to rewrite the standard. My personal opinion, it's just Patrick Miller talking, I don't think they're going to get a lot of success and general acceptance by any of the parties in the mix. There's just too many conflicting elements that are going on all at the same time. I think we're probably going to have, unfortunately, a wholesale sea change from a regulatory landscape, whether it's FERC takes over, whether it's DHS ultimately gets it. You know, there's a proposal from the White House that most of this, if not all of this, goes to DHS. And there's a lot of, you know, turf wars and, frankly, bar fights about jurisdiction between, you know, FERC and state rights, because you get all the way down into the smart grid pieces at times when you get into these discussions. And you know, then there's the standard, you know, agency turf wars between, you know, DHS and DOE and where the money goes. So all of that is still such a, you know, kind of a mystery to all of us. Most people right now are just in a holding pattern, and they're still trying to even, you know, frankly, this is 10 years. We had the original UAS 1200 out back in 2001, and, you know, that's when we had, I guess, we had actually had Appendix G of the FERC SMD, which is the predecessor to the UAS 1200, but we've basically seen this coming now for 10 years. And granted, nothing moves very quickly in our industry, but 10 years should be long enough for us to kind of at least get a handle on how we're going to approach this. And that's where we get a lot of flack from, I guess, the outside perspectives, that we're sitting on our hands. The reality is it's an extremely difficult problem to solve, and every solution so far has been inadequate and really didn't fully embrace the type of system that we're dealing with. So right now, I think before we're going to actually get some progress, we're going to have to see some pretty big changes. Whether those changes are going to be better or worse, you know, honestly, Dale, I don't have a lot of faith that they're going to get better before they get worse. It's going to get worse before it gets better. I don't see it getting better in the short term.
Okay, well, maybe item 3 will make us very hopeful. So 1 and 2, I think, were fairly predictable. You know, those were the, especially in the electric sector, obviously, the NERC SIPs are the, one of the big stories. But what's number 3?
Number 3 is the shift from prevention to detection and response. We're seeing a lot of things, and I'm really kind of generalizing here. I see a lot of folks that are kind of based on, you know, the compliance world and the Stuxnet, you know, Stuxnet-ish world, that you just kind of throw your arms up and say, oh, well, you know, we can't prevent it, so just give up. So, you know, just give up, throw your arms up. Most security folks really aren't satisfied with that approach, so they try to make something out of that. And I think when what you can't prevent, you detect and respond. So we're kind of going through those, you know, 12 stages. And at this point, we've just gone ahead and gotten past the denial, and we're on to acceptance. And with that, I'm seeing a lot of things, like a lot of good discussion on what are we measuring? How do we know that the organization, you know, what are the vitals? What are my security vitals so that I know my security health, for example? I'm not going to have a heart attack tomorrow and my blood pressure is okay. Those kinds of things, so that we can at least try to detect, because we know that it's going to be, you know, lucky if we actually do detect it. So if we can detect it, what would be an indicator? So lots of really good discussions on metrics, indicators of compromise, all of these forms of measurement to determine, you know, level of integrity or assurance in the system. And then after that, what do you do if you lose that assurance? Because the reality is, with Stuxnet, we've had a lot of discussions at, you know, various layers, whether it's from the asset owner, rights owners, all the way up into the federal space. How do you operate a system that you have a low degree of assurance in? And then conversely, or actually in addition, how do you do forensics on a live control system? You know, so how do you determine what your assurance is in that system, and then operating it with whatever determined assurance you obtain? So those discussions are actually happening. And to date, there hasn't been a lot of that. That's all really just kind of kicked up in the last 6 months or so, but I'm seeing more and more and more discussion around the fact that, okay, if they want in, they're going to get in. So how do you figure out if they're in, and then what do you do if they are?
Well, that's a very positive trend. That's some good news that people are talking more about that, because it's a natural for this space when you think about the fact that control systems are all about monitoring things and bringing back that data and visualizing it so that you can take action on it. It's just such a natural for this space. So it's good to hear people are talking about that. I know in our reports, we've very frequently, one of the things we always do in assessment reports is we kind of create a prioritized list of things that people should monitor, because that's the challenge when you start to look at this detection or monitoring is almost a limitless number of things that would be helpful to monitor. So it's kind of deciding how big of a chunk you can take at that first bite and what is the best first bite, I think. But it's good to hear that happening in these presentations.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. What we've seen for by and large is most utilities are still at the firefighter mode. So getting to any refined state where they're looking at different types of metrics and refining their views, they've still got a long way to go, many of them. But there are some that are forward-thinking that are actually starting to get to a pretty refined and mature state around their measurements. And you're absolutely right. You know, this industry is probably one of the best, if not the best, at, telemetry. And then representing that and being able to make actionable, operational, real-time decisions based on that telemetry. Interestingly enough, we haven't solved that same problem around our security telemetry, but we seem to be really damn good at it everywhere else. So I think we're well-positioned to actually crack the nut and get it done right. We just haven't really put our brains to it and focused on it yet.
Let me take this in a different direction. You said now on this various events that you've been going to, you've been meeting with vendors and government agencies more than the old EnergySec used to, that was really owner-operator focused. We hear a lot about what owner-operators are looking for, but are you getting any information from vendors saying, this is what we really need as a vendor to improve security of control systems?
Yeah. We're probably going to ramp up a program next year, and this is still kind of in its nascent stages in discussion. We're running it past the vendors as we come across them, trying just to outreach directly with them. And there are some of them that are in varying stages of, and I know this subject's near and dear to your heart, but vulnerability disclosure and how they handle their own internal vulnerability management processes. Getting them, how are they going to figure out their internal communications, external communications, vetting, liaising with both the discoverer, the users of the system, the federal entities that are necessary, the international entities that are necessary, because most of these control systems are not just sold in the U.S. So they're really struggling with that, and they don't have anybody to go to help them put together a program that's kind of comprehensive. So we're looking at kicking off a almost like an open mic from the industry. What would you like to see? How would you like to see the vendors handle this? What would be best for you as a user of this system? Because ultimately, you are the customer, and this has the greatest degree of impact on you. How would you like to see these vendors handle this? Then we can take that back to those vendors, and with some DOE funding that we have and probably some cost share put in by the vendor, and help them get to that state that was articulated by the industry or by the users of those systems, and really help them at least kind of normalize or standardize on a common approach to dealing with these issues. And that way, you know, you're not having such a kind of a inconsistent and haphazard response from the varying vendors. And even it can be, you know, varying lines of business or branches within the same company. So that's one of our big pushes, to try to help these vendors kind of understand the situation and then refine those programs so that the industry gets a much better response in terms of kind of a response product at the end of the effort. So that's one of our big pushes next year, to deal with the vendors. They really are struggling with this. Other things we're hearing from vendors is, and we have a grain of salt in terms of whether we believe it that much, but they're telling us that they're not hearing from the asset owners what security features they want in their products. I've actually spoken directly with some of the wrench turners out there, and they say that they've been communicating this openly. Whether or not their communication made it through the procurement path and all these other things, and in some cases, what gets communicated by the folks that do this day-to-day gets munged by the layers between them and the people at the manufacturer or the vendor, people that actually understand it. There's too many filters between those two points. So we're looking at, obviously there's the SCADA procurement language out there, and I don't know of a single product out there that actually meets every point in that. It's kind of like trying to comply to, 27001 or something. But So we're trying to at least help both sides get some common language around what they need and what the vendors can supply and how fast they can supply it, and not just saying, you're the first person that asked for this, that'll cost you $1 million. So really just trying to level that playing field, because really as a nonprofit, that's our goal, is really greater good, is that everybody really needs to benefit from the efforts that we're on.
Now, you mentioned when you were talking about the vendors and what they're asking for, you mentioned this open mic process, and I guess it's important to say you and the EnergySec team has not just been attending events and speaking at them, but you've also been holding some of these, this was probably under the NESCO umbrella, some of these voice of the industry events where people are encouraged to go there and talk about what they're concerned about in various topics. I think there was recently one on metrics and such. And those seem to be quite good, although I haven't had a chance to attend those. But as you go to either an event or your own voice of the industry sort of thing, has there been a big surprise to you where you either didn't think about it yourself, or you were surprised that it was such an important issue to so many people in the community?
You know, actually, no. I wish we would have had, some greater revelations. But you're right. We, for the most part, our voice of the industry meetings are how we keep our finger on the pulse of the industry. We have, obviously, our asset owner-only discussion areas and collaboration areas where we see plenty of the traffic there that happens. But some things people just don't discuss, even via email or via collaboration suites. Whether it's an RSA or, any of the other events, B-sides, you name it, we'll show up and we'll hold the voice of the industry meeting. And that's where we, frankly, the industry gets enough being told what to do. And this is their chance to not, we're not telling them what to do at all. We just show up, we pull up the therapy couch, get out the yellow notepad and say, okay, tell us your problems. What keeps you up at night? If you had all the money in the world, what would you solve? We take all that back and then summarize that. So we haven't really seen anything that's been just, groundbreaking or completely unforeseen. I would say probably the thing that did surprise me more than anything was that everybody is so literally in a locked and frozen state due to compliance that virtually nothing else is getting done. And I having been on the audit side of that, having audited for WEC for a couple of years and stood up that program, and I actually saw the regulatory sausage being made from the inside. To see it now back out in the asset owner space and hearing those stories from the field, it's rather surprising to see just how much, kind of gridlock is actually happening within the utility around these compliance pieces. So most of the discussions we hear about are really just rants about compliance. How do they get more money? How do they get more funding? How do they stop the bleeding of security staff over to the compliance piece? They're losing good people. Nobody wants to stay in the business anymore. They're all leaving and going to finance or other industries. So most of what we're hearing, I would say that's probably the biggest, most surprising thing I'd heard was the level of impact that compliance is actually having on the security of the industry. I would say it's pretty easy to tell based on what we're hearing that the asset owners do not feel it's providing the level of security that is being marketed. It's actually causing the industry a greater degree of problem.
Yeah, we're very fortunate in that we do a fair amount of business overseas with electric utilities and also in the U.S. with non-electric organizations, water, oil and gas, and that sort of thing. But I can tell you the electric work is the least fun to do now. U.S. North American electric work is the least fun. And we actually don't do it with new clients. We just have clients that we've had for 6 or 8 years that we still support. But we blogged on this a while ago. Some of the clients that we had a long time ago, we actually saw that their security posture has certainly not improved and in some cases decreased because of SIP. The ones that were very active in developing security controls and a security program, SIP has actually retarded their progress. And I'm sure that wasn't the intention of it, but it's kind of a sad state of affairs. I did want to just touch on one last thing. I hadn't heard, are you guys going to put on your EnergySec annual event this year? For listeners, I would say that's probably been one of the best events over the last 5 or so years in the sense that it brought out primarily owner-operators. It was one of the few events where you weren't swarmed with vendors. There were actually people that ran SCADA and DCS systems that attending that event. Is that been announced or scheduled yet for 2011?
Yeah. We've merged with the guys that do the Smart Grid East and West, and we're going to run a pretty healthy Smart Grid track because it's getting a tremendous amount of attention. You know, I didn't want to bring it into the ICS discussion because arguably it is, it isn't. It's more of a consumer-based approach than, you know, we could get up into the synchrophaser discussions and it would probably qualify, but we're still getting a lot of our effort focused on the rollout of Smart Grid and how to help the utilities kind of deal with that, because that's still it's a tidal wave of problem for them right now. Even the ones that aren't doing it are having to justify why they're not. The ones that are now having to justify why they're replacing a lot of what they did. So we've merged with them. We have a healthy say in terms of the content. So it's going to look and feel a lot like an EnergySec summit. It's just going to be a little bit bigger and a lot more marketed because it's we partnered with somebody to help share that cost in terms of the marketing bill. But it's happening at in San Diego, and it's the October 3rd through 5th, and it's on our website, energysec.org, and I really appreciate that. Yeah, the summit has been a tremendous success for us, and we hope to continue that this year as well.
So you partnered with Mike Amati's event? Is that the one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike Amati and Tim Downs.
Okay, yeah, because I attended that in Knoxville the last time they held it. But that event was quite a bit different than EnergySec. So hopefully you're not going to lose that EnergySec feel to it by adding the Smart Grid tracks. Have you looked at all at the program yet?
That's our hope, too. And given the fact that we've got a fair say and a fair share of the content, I think maybe we're obviously going to have to learn as we go. But the reality is we've got some restrictions around the grant that we have. And remember, the original EnergySec group was completely volunteer. It was not funded in any way. And all of us basically ran the organization for several years on, you know, our own backs, out of our own pockets. And the summit was managed by basically a handful of us, and vendors foot the bill. So we're actually looking to go for sponsorships this year and kind of changing the model so we can deliver a higher degree of content, make it a lot longer. And we think it's actually going to be a benefit because we're bringing in a higher degree of talent that can help us organize the event, and then bring the kind of content that we want. They're also bringing their type of content. So overall, we think that the mix is going to be greater than the sum of its parts.
Well, that would be good because Mike's event was quite good.
Yeah.
Especially if you were interested in AMI security. That part of Smart Grid was extremely strong, and obviously I already sang the praises of EnergySec's past events, so maybe the combination, if you can make it greater than the sum, that'd be quite an event. And we'll put, in the podcast notes, we'll put a link to that event as well. Thank you very much, Patrick, for giving us a report of what you've been seeing out there at events, and keep us posted on what's new with NESCO.
I will do, and thanks for having me.
Well, that's the show for August 2011. I want to thank my guests, Joel Langill, the SCADA hacker. You can see him at his site, SCADAhacker.com, and Patrick Miller, the CEO and president of EnergySec. You can learn more about EnergySec and NESCO at EnergySec.org. This month in Control System Security is sponsored by Waterfall Security Solutions. Sleep better at night. Waterfall's unidirectional gateways absolutely prevent access to your critical assets. Waterfall Security Gateways make compliance with NERC SIP, CFATS, NIST, and other regulations easy while preserving essential real-time data flows. Join security leaders in many industries who have discovered strong security in unidirectional gateways. Learn more about their security solutions at waterfall-security.com. Also by Schweitzer Engineering Labs, SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable. At selinc.com/cybersecurity. And finally, by Nitro Security. Nitro Security is the leader in security event management and compliance solutions for industrial control networks. Learn more at nitrosecurity.com. If you have any suggestions for this month in Control System Security, please send them to info@digitalbond.com. And we'll see you back after the dog days of summer are over in September on This Month in Control Systems Security.